The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests. Tonight's event is the Sandra Schaber Memorial Lecture, and I want to thank her family and her friends for their generosity and for choosing to honor her memory in this way. Recognized by the National Law Journal as one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America, Catherine Colbert made history in 1992 when she argued the case Planned Parenthood. I hope she hears you backstage. When she argued the case Planned Parenthood v. Casey before the U.S. Supreme Court, a case widely recognized as protecting the right to an abortion guaranteed by Roe v. Wade. The founder of the Athena Center for Leadership at Barnard College and the co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights, she created and was the executive producer of NPR's Justice Talking series. Julie F.K. has spent decades on the front line of the legal fight to advance gender equality and religious freedom. After starting her career in law as a staff attorney at the Center for Reproductive Rights, she has since helped pave the way for the legalization of abortion in Ireland, fought to protect the parenting rights of people leaving fundamentalist communities, and served as a founding president of Women's Link Worldwide. In their book, Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom, Catherine and Julie offer a comprehensive account of the struggle to safeguard the protections of Roe v. Wade and preserve women's fundamental reproductive rights in the face of nearly 50 years of legal battles. Tonight, Catherine and Julie are joined in conversation with Dorothy Roberts, who is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. She is also founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society in the Center for Africana Studies, and the author of several books that focus on health, social justice, and bioethics. Her forthcoming book, Torn Apart: How the Child Welfare System Destroys Black Families and How Abolition Can Build a Safer World, will be published in April. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this really important conversation about this important book. I was telling Kitty and Julie, I can't imagine a more timely occasion for this topic, right? And so I'm really just so excited to jump in and talk with you about your book. It seems like every few years since the Webster decision, there's this question, will Roe survive? I know you've probably also been engaged in so many conversations where the question was, year after year, decade after decade, is Roe gonna survive? And it seems like right now, it's more of an urgent question than ever, and a scary question, right, than ever before. So, Julie, your book is called Controlling Women, and you point out in the book that abortion matters a lot. I'm paraphrasing here. Can you just, to open up, tell us why you call the book Controlling Women, and why abortion is such an important topic?
Yes, first of all, I want to say how thrilled I am to be here and sort of a guest in Kitty's hometown and home crowd, and with you, Dorothy, as well. And And I will say what a fangirl I am of your work and how much I and so many others have learned and how we think about this, and particularly how we think about why abortion is about controlling women. And it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek title because, you know, as we've talked a lot about throughout the book, it's really looking at how the opposition sees the issue, and that many people who believe strongly that abortion should not be a decision made by a woman or a pregnant person are ones who have very traditional senses of the world of gender roles, that men are breadwinners, women are caregivers and childbearers. There's a real hierarchy among genders and a real hierarchy among race and what kinds of babies and who should be having babies. And Kitty and I really talk in this book about how this is not a religious issue. It's not a deep philosophical issue about when life begins. It's really about who gets to make the decisions about whether and when and with whom to have children or not have children, and really who gets to decide really fundamental human rights issues around bodily integrity, liberty, and participation in society.
Yeah, I think it is really important to point out how the politics of gender and race have always shaped who gets to make these decisions, not so much about what the decisions are as who has the power to make them, and the kinds of hierarchies we have in our society that value some people's childbearing and not others. So maybe to get to the legal issues here, Kitty, you can explain the significance of Roe versus Wade, and then, as we heard, you argued the Casey decision before the U.S. Supreme Court. It saved Roe versus Wade, but it also allowed for a lot of restrictions on access to abortion. I would say it's amazing that the Supreme Court would have allowed for states to affirmatively interfere in people's constitutional rights. There's something wrong with that, right? So can you help us to understand the legal implications of Roe and then both the positive and the negative about the Casey decision?
Well, thank you, Dorothy, and like Julie, I'm quite a fan, so I'm thrilled that you're here. And for all of you out there, I can see many faces through the masks, and I know my friends are here. So thank you all for joining us. So just kind of the basics. In 1973, the Supreme Court decided Roe. They created in Roe what I think of as the highest level of constitutional protection. As a general matter, any effort by any state to restrict abortion following Roe would be found unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. The same level of protection that you would get for free speech or for voting rights or kind of the most important values in our society. And they characterized the right as one of making a decision in consultation with a doctor to decide whether to have an abortion or to carry a pregnancy to term. So it was a reciprocal arrangement that was protected. That essentially stayed in place, at least a good portion of it, until 1992. Now, there were a number of significant incursions, even in the early days. Particularly, the most problematic was the cutoff of Medicaid funding for abortion that occurred around 1976. And in 1980, the Supreme Court upheld that and essentially made a distinction between women who had the means to have an abortion and those who did not. And basically the court said, we don't care all that much about those who did not. That was the beginning of what we saw as the whittling away of the right as originally created. But by 1992, things got a lot more dramatic because at that point, as you all probably remember, a bill in Pennsylvania was passed adding a variety of restrictions, and it went up to the Supreme Court. And the question at that point, which was about a week following the affirmance or the confirmation of Justice Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court, at that point, the answer to the question, is Roe dead, was, well, we think so. And at that point, why? Because really the only thing that matters in going to the Supreme Court, and I often say I learned everything I know from Sesame Street, Why? Because you've got to learn to count. And the only number that matters is five. And even in 1992, we thought there were five votes to overturn Roe. And in fact, and I will just say this, in fact, we were correct. Following my argument, the justices go back, they take a vote. Seven justices voted to uphold the Pennsylvania restrictions. Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote a draft opinion that overturned Roe. And while he didn't say it in the kind of, we overturned Roe, he didn't say those fatal words, Justice Stevens has characterized it as a repudiation of the central holding of Roe. And it wasn't until Justice Kennedy, a couple of weeks later, changed his mind that we got the opinion we got. And Justice Kennedy joined with Justices O'Connor and Souter, and they issued a joint opinion that did two things. And I'm going to stop there because I know there's a lot we need to talk about. But basically what they did in Casey is they said every woman has a right to choose abortion up until viability. A state can't ban abortion, but a state can enact restrictions as long as those restrictions do not place an undue burden on women. And as we've seen in the two decades since Casey was decided, the meaning of an undue burden changed. Our courts became more conservative. State legislatures became more adamantly opposed to abortion. And hundreds of restrictions have been enacted, have been upheld by the courts. And for the most part, the women who have traditionally been left out, low-income women, teenagers, rural women, women who are disabled, women of color who are disproportionately represented in those groups, but also people who are subject to systemic racism in the healthcare system, are functionally unable to get abortions in many, many states. There's only 11% of the counties in this country that have an abortion provider. There are six states with one provider. And as a result, many, many women, even today, can't obtain abortions.
Yeah, it's a really pitiful history of how this constitutional right has been treated by the U.S. Supreme Court after Casey, despite the upholding of the essential, right, the essential meaning of Roe. But it's almost, let's see how much states can do to put barriers in front of people. I don't know of any other constitutional right that's treated that way. And I'm so glad that you brought up the way in which these decisions affect different groups differently. Starting from the Hyde Amendment and the Supreme Court upholding it soon after Roe v. Wade, I'm glad you brought, that's a sign that the idea that we should have access, actual access to abortion services was already struck down, right, or from the beginning. And now we have this situation where effectively abortion is banned for millions of people in the United States, upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. But now, let's look at the situation now. We are at a point where the bans in Mississippi and Texas, or, you know, Texas has this trick where, you know, they're allowed, this law allows for private individuals to sue. But effectively, they have turned the time that you can get an abortion legally into an impossibility, right? A practical impossibility. So can you say more about, Kitty, about what has been the outcome of the change in the Supreme Court membership? You pointed out the only important number is five, and now we probably have six conservative members of the court. So let's look at this current situation. Who's on the court? What are the implications? What are what should we look for in these two cases from Texas and Mississippi that are pending before this may I say, right-wing U.S. Supreme Court.
All right, so I'm going to be really direct.
Yeah.
Roe's dead. I mean, there is just, there within the year, Roe and Casey will be reversed. Okay? There's no middle ground here. Whatever the press is telling you, there are five votes on this court that are going to overrule Roe and Casey. They probably won't say the magic words, like Justice Rehnquist, but they will return to the states the power to ban abortion. How do we know that? Well, all you need to do is look at how they've already ruled in the Texas case. Yeah. Now, Dorothy alluded to what's going on in Texas. There's a ban, 5-week ban, 6-week ban. But the key part of that, the key part of that statute is it says states can't enforce it, but individuals can. Okay? So any individual, no matter where they are in the country, can sue any abortion doctor for not only performing an abortion, but for helping somebody perform an abortion. So not just the doctors, but the taxi drivers or the woman who brings their friend to the clinic. And the way it's set up is really trying to do an end run around the federal courts. They've been successful. The court ruled the other day, it's the most depressing decision. Don't read it. Trust me.
You really, let Kitty read it for you.
You don't want to read it. It is extraordinary because it essentially says states have the power to do anything to existing federal constitutional rights. It doesn't matter if it's just abortion. It could be the right to carry a gun. It could be the right to vote. It could, they are essentially giving unlimited power to the states to eliminate or functionally eradicate constitutional liberties that have been recognized for centuries, and I just am blown away. But the critical fact is five of them voted to let the law stay in effect and essentially make it almost impossible to enjoin the law, even though, you know, there's a lot of technical language in it, and a couple of state authorities may be sued, the licensing authorities. But the reality is no one is going to perform abortions under this current scheme. And states across the country are adopting very similar ones as we speak. So we know things are can get worse, because even though there's lots of restrictions in place, by the time the Mississippi case is decided, sometime between now and the end of June, states will be able to ban abortions. That means we're in trouble and we got to get active. And we're going to talk a lot about that tonight.
And I think they do put a veneer of reasonableness over it, particularly Justice Roberts, who, this is the so-called Roberts Court. It bears his name, and I think he's urging the court to move more slowly to protect its own credibility. He was sort of dancing around this 15-week line in the Mississippi case, and so it's possible that they'll do away with Roe in two whacks instead of one. I think Kitty and I go back and forth on that, mostly because of my undying optimism or delusionalness on some of this. But, you know, there's no way that they can uphold Roe and Casey and have a 15-week ban. It's a pre-viability ban. You can't do that under Roe and Casey. Yeah. So to say that, as he did, well, you still have a choice, but 15 weeks is enough time to make a choice, is both wrong legally and also, I think, really offensive. It's sort of like gives this image that women are sitting around contemplating whether to re-wallpaper the living room, and you have 15 weeks. And similarly with the Texas ban at 6 weeks is really a ban on nearly all abortion, because it does take so long to realize that you're pregnant and to come to that decision and things. So there's a real sort of disingenuousness about how the courts are approaching this, and that they're saying we're going to return this to the states to, you know, look at, or that Roe and Casey were outliers. And they don't dance around other constitutional rights like that. Right. And, you know, I think the last time that they really deferred to states' rights to this extent was around Jim Crow. And I don't think that's accidental, of this let the states run roughshod over people's rights.
Yeah. That's a really good analogy. It's very much like that, including the giving individuals the right to spy on and track down and report sounds to me like the Fugitive Slave Act. It really is reminiscent of Jim Crow prior eras that were supposed to be over with the civil rights legislation, and just complete devaluation of women's lives and health. It's astonishing. It's scary. So let's turn to what we need to do. And I'll start with you, Julie, because you have an experience in Ireland where a nation that was opposed to abortion became one that allowed it based on a human rights approach. Can you tell us about how that happened and what a human rights approach to abortion would be, and how maybe how that's a way that we could start thinking about this?
Sure, I'm happy to. I think that may be some of the underpinnings of my optimism of having seen Ireland go from a constitutional provision that equated the life of the unborn with the life of the mother, which was passed in 1983, in part as a reaction to Roe v. Wade. The Irish Supreme Court had legalized access to contraception for married women right around that time. They saw Roe v. Wade come out and use similar legal language, and there was a real fear that legalized abortion would come to the courts in Ireland. The government, who was both beholden to the Catholic powers that be, as well as trying to distract from some of its own scandalous behavior and a lot of troubles up in the north, thought that, you know, a national referendum on abortion would be a really good way to increase its own political power. And so in 1983, there was a vote, and, you know, whether this is the kind of decision that should be put up to a popular vote when it's a fundamental right and a human right at that is another question. But for decades and decades, there was no abortion in Ireland, and what they had was what was called the Irish solution to the Irish problem. And that meant that women seeking abortion services traveled to England and to other countries. They had an abortion rate that was similar to countries where abortion was fully legal, because when abortion is outlawed, it doesn't go away, it goes underground. And people traveled at great cost and stigmatization and difficulty, and really, you know, and obviously it delayed their getting access to abortion, and it was a very isolating experience, and not everybody made it. Not everybody was able to travel, and some people were forced to continue their pregnancy. I arrived in Ireland around 2000. I had been working at the Center for Reproductive Rights, and Kitty and others had trained me well to think aggressively and to use litigation as one of the many tools. And when I arrived in Ireland, it was still at that point in time where people, when they would say abortion, that nobody would really say it out loud. They didn't want to talk about it. There were people who were very active on it, but they didn't want other people to know. I mean, I don't think you can underestimate how stigmatizing it becomes when it's criminalized. People who were not in preschool like I was when Roe v. Wade came out remember similarly in this country. But you know, the reality was that it also affected all maternal health care, because when you are treating somebody who is pregnant, whether from miscarriage management or IVF or any range of behaviors, when abortion is criminalized, there's less experience in the medical community, and it really casts a chill on how they address women. I was fortunate to work with the Irish Family Planning Association to bring a lawsuit on behalf of three women to the European Court of Human Rights, which is the premier human rights court in Europe. It enforces the European Convention on Human Rights, which is a convention signed by about 45 different countries. And we brought the case on behalf of three women with very different circumstances, trying to show the court how normal abortion is as a part of women's lives for very different and disparate reasons. The case took a really long time, as cases do, but this court in particular, it took about 5+ years for the case to work its way through to the Grand Chamber. And so in the meantime, we were really able to start talking about this as a human rights issue. We were able to get away from the religious arguments. We were able to sidestep some of the, you know, you're not respecting the Catholic country and those kinds of things. And the sort of, as I said before, the philosophical question of when life begins, and really allowing women to start talking in a very modern way about what it meant to them to have access to abortion, whether they would ever need it or not, but what it said when that right was respected as a human right and was being taken seriously by a human rights tribunal. We eventually won on behalf of one of my clients, who the court said had been denied the ability to obtain a life-saving abortion or even to get information about it. She had successfully traveled to England to save her own life and to terminate the pregnancy. And in the meantime, while the Irish government was trying to, I guess, drag its heels and study the court's recommendation that it pass a mechanism for life-saving abortion, there was a tragic death of a young woman named Savita Halappanavar that made international news. She had a wanted pregnancy and was experiencing a miscarriage. She was in a Galway hospital, and her doctors just did not know what to do. They could still detect a heartbeat, and so they didn't treat her and didn't treat her. And by the time they did, because they couldn't hear a heartbeat anymore, she had had sepsis and ultimately died from it. And it was horribly unnecessary, and it really lit the political scene. And I think at that point, we were able to talk more directly about what this means to women, what it means to families. And it's something that I've, you know, fear happening in this country. I know that denying women abortion services right now even can cause them to lose their health or fertility or even their lives. And it's something that I think we do need to start talking about in human rights terms, because that's what brings so many of us to this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really important way of approaching reproductive freedom. And it reminds me a lot of work I've been doing it for reproductive justice and the framework of reproductive justice, which is a human rights approach that sees abortion, the right to terminate a pregnancy, alongside the right to have a child and the right to raise your children in a healthy and safe and nurturing environment, and a society that values your children as well, and the social structures that are important to be able to make these decisions. I think that that is, for all the reasons you've been talking about, an important way of approaching this. As you pointed out, denying access to abortion affects the health of people who want to have children as well. In fact, your example of this woman who died, she wasn't planning to have an abortion. She was planning to have a baby, but because of this devaluation of autonomy and human rights and life of a human being, you know, born human being, it cost her life.
And you're right, the parallels to the United States are many, and particularly around access to maternity care, to abortion care. We see a really disproportionate rate of maternal mortality in this country, particularly for women of color, particularly for Black women at all economic levels. And that structural inequality that makes access to care, whether it's in rural areas or by income level, has a really damaging effect on people in this. And I think that's important when we have these conversations about abortion, that it's not just the right to abortion, but the right to safe and healthy pregnancy. And you know, we call our book about preserving reproductive freedom because abortion is certainly in the crosshairs right now. But, you know, as Kitty was saying, of even the limited access to abortion rights as well as to maternal health care and postpartum care is at a crisis level already in this country.
It's really horrifying. The United States is the only so-called developed nation whose maternal mortality rate is increasing. Even most developing nations don't have an increasing maternal mortality rate. And as you pointed out, Black women have at least double the rate of maternal mortality. Three times. I've seen various.
It depends geographically.
Amnesty International said four times the rate. It depends. In the Mississippi Delta, it's healthier to have a baby in Rwanda, for if you're a Black woman, than there. And also, I like to remind people that maternal mortality means death from a pregnancy-related cause. It can be death from not getting good health care, prenatal care, from not getting postnatal care, from problems in delivery, and also from unsafe abortions. Any of those, we have to see them all as part of our human rights. So I'm so glad.
And Mississippi, where they are scrambling over themselves to shut down the last remaining abortion clinic, They are also denying Medicaid expansion, and I think women get cut off very quickly after delivering, and that most dangerous period postpartum for maternal mortality is actually that sort of so-called fourth trimester. So when you talk about valuing women, the proof is in the pudding, as they say.
Yeah. So, Kitty, can you say more about the kinds of policy and political initiatives that we need to be taking up now? Maybe some you've seen that have worked that might give us some more hope and also some guidance of what to do?
So there's a host of policy alternatives. I think we talk about 58 different ones in the book. But what I'd actually like to do is to preface that with the view that if states can ban abortion, the only thing we can do and the best thing to do now is to build back political power so that we can actually enact those great policies. So in the wake of the court taking away our rights, I see really three things we need to do. One, we have to take care of women. There are probably 300 to 350,000 women who will live in states that ban abortion. As many as 26 states that are going to range from Georgia all the way west to Texas, from North Dakota south to Nevada. We're talking about huge swaths of states across this country. And about a third of the population of women of childbearing age. So we're maybe, you know, about a little over 900,000 abortions a year. So we're probably talking about 300 to 350,000 women who will be living in states where abortion is banned. So we need to take care of those women. That means helping them get to states like Pennsylvania and other states where abortion will be safe. There's 15, what I think of as 15 safe states. But that's not enough. We also have to do two other things. One is we got to do what I've been calling that badass, we got to build a badass social justice movement. It's no longer okay to sit back and let this happen without crying out loud, this is wrong, we can't do this. If it takes, it will take all kinds of ways to demonstrate that outrage. But even more important is we've got to build political power. And that means taking back the ability to elect state legislators who are committed to reproductive freedom and justice. It means having a Congress that will vote, could pass a national law protecting rights, but most importantly, changing who is making the laws. You know, people will tell you till they're blue in the face, we've done everything we can to convince people to change their minds. We're not going to convince any legislators to change their minds. The only alternative is to get rid of the bad guys. And I'm thrilled that in Pennsylvania there's lots of groups that are working on that. I know that there are representatives of Represent who are here tonight, back there. They'll be in the back. Turn PA Blue, of Indivisible, Change PA. There's lots and lots of groups doing this. We all need to help them. And then helping women as well is really important. And there are groups all over the country that are raising funds to help women to travel. And we need raising funds to help women here in Pennsylvania. We've already got reports of people coming into Pennsylvania because there are direct flights from Texas. Remember American Airlines? Well, Dallas to Philadelphia is quite a regular route. Women will be coming to Pennsylvania to have abortions because we're not only going to see Texas with a ban, but probably 25 other states as well.
Yeah, that's getting down to brass tacks, right?
I mean, I think it's getting rid of the bad guys and bad women, but also the mediocres. I mean, we need champions now, and, you know, people keep asking Kitty and me lately, well, this is good because, you know, things will get so bad that people will get active. You know, I do think the phoenix will rise from the ashes, but I'm very concerned about the women and people seeking abortion who are going to be the ashes, and we're in for some really rough times for a lot of people, and until we restore these rights and until we expand them so that people don't have to travel so far. I always say sort of the the states that will remain legal are sort of make a donut with a really big hole in the middle. And I took another look at the map today, and it looked like a donut that your dog had eaten. I mean, it's very, very few states. And those states that are blue states that continue to have abortion services are really going to have to facilitate people traveling from other states. So medication abortion, which is a great sort of medical development in that women can take pills to have a termination up to about 11 weeks. In those states that have medication abortion, they're going to have it a lot more widely available. So in some of these doc-in-a-box or minute clinics that we've all depended on so much during COVID, they should be offering medication and possibly even surgical abortion so that women who are traveling, low-income women who can't take time off from work and need extended hours, those kinds of things, we need to make medication abortion much more widely available. We need to have better reimbursement rates from our government so that the clinics who are taking on more patients have the capacity to do so and to expand. Mm-hmm. And we really need to look at how else we can both philanthropically and publicly fund people's travel in these blue states. This is a global human rights issue, and it's one that, you know, those of us who care deeply about it will be helping the so-called abortion migration that's going to be happening and that we've seen happen out of Texas. I mean, we're in day 100 and something of Texas has had very few abortion services since September 1. I keep trying to get someone to put a big clock in Times Square that keeps track of how many days it's been, because we've lost track, and it's become the new normal in a way. And I think in many ways it's the canary in the coal mine of what the Supreme Court's going to do. And so rather than waiting until June or July where they release their opinion, we really do need to get active now. And you know, in some ways, you all are here, and so it's a bit preaching to the choir, to which Kitty and I always say, grab a friend, grab an ally, grab 10 friends. Kitty has brought me down to Pennsylvania many times to walk door to door to door to door because I live in Brooklyn, which is pretty solidly blue, although sometimes we go to Staten Island. And, you know, I think this... That was actually not a joke, but I think it's really go time for so many of us, and, you know, Pennsylvania is going to be a key state in this, so, you know, bring more people in is what we keep saying.
Yeah, well, you've gotten to the last question I was going to ask about what should we all be doing? You know, what is your advice for the people sitting here and listening online for what they can personally do to ensure reproductive freedom in America? Any other, you've given some, but I wonder if you want to expand on that.
Right, so I would just, my favorite law actually, I just wanted to mention it, comes out of California, which is requiring every clinic at every university campus, University of California and California State campuses, to provide medication abortion at the student health centers. That's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are working on college campuses, every college campus in America ought to be doing that, not just those in California, at least everyone in blue states where they legally can. And so I think that's, if you're a young activist, I'd start at home, start on your campus, make sure they're providing medication abortion, and if they're not, cause some trouble to make sure they do. Things like that, mm-hmm. to broaden access. And then I just want to say that I think that this notion that we've been talking about of reproductive freedom being broader than abortion, mm-hmm. there's a whole list of services, things like childcare, early childhood education, over-the-counter birth control, mm-hmm. The ability to have infertility services provided to people, the ability to ensure that the decision to choose to have a child is as supported as we can possibly make mm-hmm. it be. And that is going to take a radical rethinking of social policy, that care agenda. Which has been denigrated by our opponents, ironically, because of course they're all about having forcing women to have a baby. But that care agenda is really denigrated, and we need to rise that up. The Biden Build Back Better plan actually has a whole lot of those policy alternatives in it. So if any of you are best friends with Joe Manchin, it's time to act. Certainly
get him a copy of our book. I would add, I mean, Kitty always says the right had a 50-year plan. We need a 50-year plan. I'm a little impatient for a 50-year plan, but I think long-term on our wish list, and as we talk about in the book, is a gender equity amendment to the Constitution. Our Constitution, our so-called beloved founding fathers, did not write the Constitution with women or people of color in mind, or if they did, they weren't thinking very good thoughts about us. So it's time to really upgrade the Constitution. And, you know, when you look at how the Supreme Court talks about the abortion issue, they often go back and say, well, there isn't anything in the Constitution, there's nothing there, so let's put something there for them. Mm-hmm. And the gender equity amendment would be kind of a supercharged equal rights amendment, and one that would really have sort of human rights infusion that recognizes the intersectionality of gender and race and the multi forms of discrimination that LGBTQ plus folks face, and really brings us to where we want to be and why this issue matters. And I think it aligns very well with our American values, and with where and how we want to see this country provide access to fundamental human rights around healthcare and education and bodily integrity. And so that's our kind of big dream. The building blocks to get there are exactly the kind of political power we're talking about, because you would need to have a supermajority of the states or more political power in Washington. So there are so many reasons, both now and for the future, to really start thinking big and bringing in more allies to help us get there.
Yeah, well, thank you. I want to leave time for Q&A. We'd like to engage with all of you. I want to also apologize. I forgot to let you both read from your book, but hopefully this gives you a great idea of the value and importance of this book, and you'll buy a copy and read all of it for yourselves. So now I think we have, yes, the roving microphones, and please raise your hand if you have a question for Kitty and Julie.
Hi, my husband and I, our daughter is an abortion provider who travels. And she's been getting a lot of people from Texas to where she practices. And I know that in Philadelphia, she tried to have a ready grant to teach all family practitioners to be able to provide abortions in their offices. But Tower Health wouldn't let her accept the grant that she had been awarded to do the training. Another reason to hate Tower Health. But what protections do you see for the abortion providers and for the nurses and for the people who are in the organizations? I know in Philly we have the Abortion Liberation Fund, and you know we have lots of organizations. Yay, Alf. But what is there to protect some of the people doing the medical work?
Well, as we document in the book, violence against abortion providers, at least in the 80s and 90s, was really prevalent, really, really problematic. Many doctors died, were killed and assassinated. Others were harmed through all kinds of violence. And I expect, unfortunately, that violence against providers will increase in the near future, because the license to those who hate women has been given such, the Viagra is growing the those against us. I think that we do need to support and thank who I think to be the heroes in this, which are the docs and the medical providers, nurses, docs, midwives, who are doing just extraordinary work. And I am hopeful that other docs will step up, not just OBGYNs, but family practice doctors, doctors who do any doctor can prescribe a drug, okay? And the protocols for medication abortion are not that difficult to learn. You could probably learn them in an hour and a half. Is that right, Barbara? An hour and a half, yeah, but maybe 2 hours. So all doctors ought to be prepared to, in safe states, be prepared to help provide medication abortion to as many people as we can, so that the smart women in illegal states will find their way to that remedy if possible. I can't advocate breaking the law, but I can say that women are really smart. They will find a way to get what they need. Mm-hmm. And the easier it is to get in safe states, smart women will find it. So that's my goal here.
Yeah, and I think having individuals like your daughter who are really stepping up to this and are taking the initiative and are also spreading the word is incredibly important, because we're going to see more and more of a need for providers of all kinds. When I was living in Ireland, when abortion was banned, it was almost impossible to get an ultrasound. They just didn't do fetal testing, because why would they if a termination was not an option? They didn't know how to do miscarriage management. These other states are not just going to lose their abortion services, they're going to lose a whole host of top-notch maternal medicine. And so having more mid-level practitioners available to do abortion services, having more doctors and less sort of siloing of abortion care is going to be more important than ever. New York City had an initiative that provided city-funded medical schools and hospitals had to teach first trimester abortion. That was actually something that Mayor Bloomberg had stood behind, and I think, you know, looking at political power and requirements so that that training happens and we increase the number of providers is going to be more essential than ever. And thank you to your daughter, too, and her clearly supportive parents.
In regards to what you said about maternal fetal medicine, what has been the position of ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, because they need to know, you know, are they just in Texas and Mississippi just standing by?
No. I mean, ACOG has traditionally over the years been a tremendous supporter of reproductive freedom in the broadest possible way, in trying to bring some sense of what really happens to women. So they've been great. My first case in the Supreme Court was American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists versus Thornburg. So ACOG has been there from the get-go, and they're great. And the American Medical Association as well. But we need more than just those groups. We need all of the social justice groups around the country to begin looking at abortion. Not just that issue you don't want to touch, that's too controversial, that's just like icky, like let's not talk about this. Mm-hmm. And begin to say, okay, we have to take a stand. And that means changing minds of even our friends, who often don't want to touch this because they think it's... How often do you read in the newspaper, almost every time you see abortion mentioned, it's prefaced with the controversial issue of abortion? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what's so controversial about a constitutional right that has been around for 50 years? Right? This isn't controversial, but it has been made so by our opponents, and we have got to push back against that and begin to change not just the ACOGs of the world, which are doing great, but all the other medical associates, you know, the family practitioners and every other medical group, as well as other just normal groups across the country that need to step on aboard and begin to exert their power.
Including corporations. I mean, we talk a lot about corporate social responsibility. Anytime I see any remotely for-profit organization or institution saying anything remotely in favor of reproductive freedom, I email it to Kitty because she's more cynical about this than I am. But, you know, if we look at how the marriage equality movement, how Black Lives Matter have brought in these sort of corporate allies, and I'm not saying that's going to solve everything to put BLM on a can of Coke or Pepsi, but I think that we need to make it more the norm that being in support of reproductive freedom, being in support of abortion rights is something that is not stigmatized, that is talked about in so-called polite company, and really becomes sort of part of what we consider our values, because the majority of people in this country do support abortion rights. And even if they didn't, at this point, you know, it is a fundamental right, it is a constitutional right for the past 50 years, and it's not something that should be so treated like a, you know, the sloppy stepsister, which, as a sloppy stepsister myself, I'm allowed to say that. But.
Thank you so much for all your work and your commitment to this vital cause. I'd like to talk a little bit more about what can we do. Do you know if, or do you have in mind anybody, any group, any people who could lead us out of this? How can we unite? Who can we turn to as a force in the movement to get us started in, on some of the roads that you have outlined?
Well, there are groups all over this country that are going to be working on this issue. In Pennsylvania, we're talking about flipping the Pennsylvania legislature and ensuring the election of a governor in this state who will veto bad laws if we can't flip the legislature. So that's the place to start politically in the state, and there's all kinds of groups working on that, from, you know, Turn PA Blue to Indivisible to Represent to, that's a fund. There's just a lot of groups. On our website, controllingwomenthebook.com, we have a list of all kinds of organizations that are working on this issue. If you want to help women, obviously the Abortion Liberation Fund of Pennsylvania is a fund that helps women pay for abortions. There's other groups that are doing that. RAP, which is a national group, NNAF, which is National Network of Abortion Funds. A lot of these are on our website, and you can take a look at it. But I wanted to say something about the power of individuals to make a difference. Each one of us in this room has a wide social network. You can see mine. I mean, it's mostly this room, right? Actually, mine and Joanne, mostly Joanne's. But I'm thrilled that you're all here, but we all have our own social networks that are broader than who's in this room, and it takes concerted effort. It takes talking about this issue. It takes getting our daughters and our sons active, and it takes getting men involved. And I have to say, for years and years and years, I always said, this is a women's issue. This is not something we want men to be able to control. And so we worked very hard to say you can't have husband notification and consent laws. We kept men out of the equation, and I feel like that's a cop-out now, because I see too many men saying, this is my wife's issue, or this is my daughter's issue, but it's not mine. And the reality is 90% of families that choose abortion, many, many are married, many of them are in committed relationships, and the decision is a joint decision. So men benefit from abortion as much as women, and I think they need to step up to the cause.
I agree. I think learning more about the issue, we haven't taken our rights for granted. We've been hoodwinked into thinking they're okay. And learning how to be good allies. I learned so much from reading Dorothy's original book, Killing the Black Body, and others over the years. I think rethinking this issue and how we talk about it is essential, and really recognizing in, 2021, this is very much about gender equity, it's about race equity, it's about human rights, and how we talk to each other about it is really important, and how we demand more of our politicians. There's a whole virtual world out there, including people on Zoom who are in the room with us tonight. There are new ways and new technologies, and there's also the door-to-door and human contact. Kitty and I talk a lot in the book about do something that works for you. We're in this for the long haul, and you have to do something that's sustainable, and I think that means having fun, having community with it, and doing the piece of the much, there are multiple lanes and different things to do, and picking something that is really meaningful to you personally.
Hi, thank you. I would like to go back to your comment earlier about Jim Crow. And I feel that one of the things that's happening, not just the erosion of rights of the individual, but also with the state's rights, that we're losing the ability to vote. And I think that if we're going to change anything legally, it's got to go back to the vote. And I'd like to know what your feelings are about, organized funds to get women, transported from Texas to Philadelphia is certainly one thing that people with money can do, but there is the voting issue. And just one little thing earlier about the Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights, is there anything like that in the United States
Not yet. But I'm going to let Kitty and Dorothy answer the bigger picture question.
Yeah, I mean, to me, voting rights are women's rights, and women's rights are voting rights. We can't win in state legislatures unless everybody has the right to fairly vote, and that we ensure that the way our districts are drawn, the gerrymandering of districts, is reduced as much as humanly possible. And you know, there's a variety of remedies that are out there. We need to get the Senate to pass them. And you know, that's a long haul, but I do think that is our only solution. And when I say take back the state legislatures, that may mean being out in front of a grocery store and signing up people to vote. I mean going door to door with voter registration forms. It may mean knocking on doors for particular candidates. All of those things are necessary, but you're absolutely right. It comes back to the ability to exercise the franchise.
And that question also points out the intersection of these right-wing movements to deny the vote for racist reasons. They're mostly targeting black voters who they know are going to, black women are the most likely of any group in the United States to vote for progressive policies. They were the least likely of any group to vote for Trump. Very, very few did, just as some examples. So the right wing, especially the Republicans that, you know, are still bowing down to Trump, they want to keep black people, immigrants, other marginalized people who have a stake in radical change in this country from voting. They're the same people that want to ban abortion. You know, they're the same people that are now trying to take over the education system and teach children a false view of U.S. history. These are joined forces of oppression. They want the most powerful people, who are mostly white men. I mean, I'm not trying to contradict what Kitty said about bringing men in. I'm just talking about this elite that want to maintain power, and they want to control women. They want to be back in Jim Crow times. That all of this is pushing back to a prior period before the civil rights movement, before the women's rights movement, to bring America back to a society that only supports their interests. And I think it is important to see all of these efforts to control marginalized people, politically marginalized people, as one joint campaign against all of us. You know, America, if we joined forces, all the people who are being oppressed by these laws, voting rights laws, criminal laws, the bans on abortion, if we joined together, we would win. And I think that's an important part of this as well, understanding our common interests in a free society, truly free society for everybody. That's what's important. I think all of us have to ask ourselves, what is it that is holding us back, and work to getting rid of these barriers that just make it harder to have a truly free and equal society.
I mean, I sort of added, I think I addressed sarcastically that there wasn't a similar body to the European Court of Human Rights, but I think the way forward is a human rights model, and not this, you know, we've got a lot of freedom in America, you know, freedom to not have health insurance, freedom to not have housing,
exactly.
Freedom to not have an education, yeah. And part of the human rights model is really looking at the government's obligation to have this sort of minimum resources and programs to allow you to live free from discrimination, yeah. And have access to these kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the European Convention on Human Rights was a response to World War II and the genocide that happened there, and really looking differently. So it's a much newer and more modern model, even though it comes out of kind of, you know, old Europe, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So we do need to really take the energy. And Dorothy talked earlier about the reproductive justice movement, which was founded by Black women in the 1980s and mm-hmm. was really a response to this and looking at what do we need resource-wise? How do we get rid of the structural inequality and racism? And so I think that is the way forward. I was lucky enough to be in Europe and see this actual, you know, glass and steel court that was all about human rights. We need to start building that approach now. We're one of four countries in the world that have not signed the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. That's an embarrassment. I mean, we're in really bad company in not signing and ratifying that treaty. And I think that way forward of looking at the demand for access to health care in this country, for an end to policing brutality, mm-hmm. for discrimination in employment and education, those kinds of values do fit better with a human rights model. It's part of why we want to renovate the Constitution. Lawyers, I think, are the last to get it often because we're so trained to look at the Constitution and think in a certain way, but activists get it. And the more we combine forces, I think the more ways forward. Mm-hmm.
I'm so sorry to say that we are out of time. Oh, no. Please join me in thanking our guests.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.